but very few people are really capable of, you know, really preparing the way they should, because they're very hemmed in by the current living arrangement, and they're surrounded by people who are full of unrealistic expectations, and they have to abide by rules that are maladaptive to the future that is ready to arrive. So people are very limited in the sorts of things that, you know, they can do. I mean, if you live in a suburban neighborhood and you start putting up, you know, little windmills that are composed of pieces of SUVs because, you know, the SUVs aren't very useful anymore, and start collecting rainwater and start plowing up your lawn and planting, you know, squash and corn and beans and things, your local property owners association will write you a big ticket for it. You will be fined, and that's very typical. And it will take a while before the property owners associations are extinct, you know. And by that time, it will be too late to start doing these things. So this is all very unfortunate.
We're living at a dangerous moment because, as we say, empire is in its last gasp. And empire, when it's in its last gasp, will do anything to sustain itself. I mean, invading Iraq was a very obvious thing to do, but the U.S. does not want to see the indigenous view of water or natural gas or oil or resources in the ground to prevail. I just came yesterday, just last night, I was at a meeting of UWA people who are fighting oil development in Colombia. And which is another place the indigenous voice is very strong. And they talk about oil in the ground should not be taken out of the ground, period. You know, that it's in the ground, and that's where it belongs. And you hear that a lot, that kind of thing. That's completely alien to the Western development and to corporate development models. Just can't be understood, even. So, as a result, the corporations and U.S., you know, and prevailing Western powers don't think anything negative at all about going in and overpowering that if they can get away with it.
I think it makes sense to have a few months' worth of supply, although it doesn't provide for fresh food, which is absolutely essential. You can, of course, you know, do simple things like sprout beans, for instance, to ward off scurvy. But you know, canned and frozen food is a mixed blessing at best. It can be used to basically ride out the immediate aftermath of commercial collapse, because with it comes a lot of anger, you know, hoarding and looting. You know, the looting is sort of an antidote to hoarding, and hoarding is what happens when, you know, a market economy runs out of, you know, key commodities. So it's best to not have to participate. And if you have, you know, some resources of your own, not a huge hoard, but enough to survive, then it may make it possible to spare yourself a lot of unpleasantness. Now, after that period, I think it will become very, very important for people to figure out ways to gain access to food.
Oh, seasons.
Bone days.
Bone days. With all that's left. Motions of everydayness and thoughts that won't leave. Leaving behind another sameness. Life to your knees. You don't know what to pray, so you keep making pleas. I want to talk a little bit about who we are, because I think the coherency of our future depends upon us knowing who we are, and I mean truly understanding who we are, because our relationship to reality and our relationship to power is based upon that understanding. But sometimes I feel like I'm in a reality where we don't remember who we are, so therefore we don't know who we are. We speak a language we don't understand, and because of this we don't know where we are. And I think that we live in a technologic reality. That these conditions are the result of a mining process. I'm going to call it a mining process. And there's a reason we are in this situation. But it's got to do with being fed upon by a system.
Bone days. In the great need.
So I want to go
no more enough
to who we are.
Everywhere. Chasing the
chase. See, we're the human beings.
Holding and taking.
And it's very important because we all know how to say the words. We know the terms. I know we know the terms because they taught them to us. They programmed this to us. And the words, human beings.
Bone days.
But our relationship to reality,
someone want to hear,
is in that definition. So human,
and nobody's living here.
The bone, flesh, and blood, the DNA of the human, the bone, flesh, and blood is literally made up of the metals, minerals, and liquids of the earth. So we are parts of the earth. We are shapes of the earth. We're forms of the earth. This is the form that we are. All of the things of the earth have the same DNA as the human does. Everything of the earth has the same DNA as the human. Everything is made up of the metals, minerals, and liquids of the earth, but the shape is just different. And the purpose is different. And being, we have being. That's our essence. That's our spirit. And all of the things of the earth have the same DNA as the human has, so all the things of the earth have being, spirit. And our relationship to power and reality is in that understanding of who we are. We are forms of the earth, and that's reality. Nothing will ever change that reality. What has changed is our perceptional relationship to reality. And what has happened to us through the millennium and through this whole technologic perception of reality, what has happened to the human beings is that, to me, it's like a disease in one way. It's like this thing just kind of spreads. And as it diseases the spirit of the people, it affects the perception of reality. So in one way, it's kind of like that. It's like a possession. But in another way, it's almost like a mechanical thing, this mining process that takes place.
Have their reasons.
And it's almost like this thing that they call technologic civilization. See, it's predatory upon our lives. Anybody ever feel something's missing from their life? Like purpose or understanding or self-worth or self, whatever the deal is, they're mining us. Right? They're mining us. And one of the objectives of this whole technologic civilized perceptional reality has got to do with erasing the memories of the human beings. Because we have a common collective experience. We are all the descendants of tribes. Back in the time of the original dream, see, we were all tribes and we were all the earth's children and we all knew that the earth was our mother and that we were a part of a spiritual reality, see, because we had being. We understood that there was a spiritual reality and we were physical in a spiritual reality. We being who we are today, however we landed in this reality, whoever we are today, we carry the genetic experience of our lineage from the very beginning. It's encoded in the DNA. It's like a genetic memory. Something about the experience of the journey. We have it in us. It's like... But anyway, within our genetic memories, somewhere hidden in there, we all come from a people. Every one of us comes from a people that understood that we lived in a spiritual reality. And because we lived in a spiritual reality, every one of our beginning ancestral peoples understood that life was about responsibility. So we were responsible for the past and the future as well as the present. And we understood that all things had being. So we knew who we were. We understood what we were saying. And we knew where we were. We knew our purpose. And this reality lives in our genetic memory, because see, as human beings, whoever we are, the individuals we are now, that experience is there. It's at 90% of the brain to tell us we can't use it. So they're using it
not to hear. What if the truth is seen and nobody's living here?
Bone days
covering the night in the tears of the stars and the way memories run. Every ending has just begun. Bone days.
The promise is the lie. Someone's want to hear.
Bone days.
What if the truth is seen and nobody's living here?
I realized as I was writing the newest book, Endgame, that I'd been bashing civilization for probably 10 years now, and I'd never defined it. I didn't know what I was talking about, and so I define it in that book as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities, and that definition is defensible both linguistically and historically. Civilization comes from civitatis, which means state or city. And historically, that's pretty much where most people start civilization, is the rise of cities. That's great, Derek, but what's a city? I've defined a city as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is that the Talua, on whose land we are now, were not civilized, because they didn't require the importation of resources. They didn't live in cities. They lived in camps, villages, and so on. And remember, the Talua lived here for 12,500 years, at least. A couple of things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, what that means is you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area. Because by definition, you're requiring the importation, which means it's not there. And once again, that means that functionally, your way of life can never be sustainable. We can talk all we want, but it won't last. New York won't last, because New York City won't last, because it requires the importation of resources. The other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, what that means is that trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if you require the importation of resources, and you need a particular resource that you are going to try to trade the next village over for, but they won't give it to you, you'll take it because you require it. It's not some resource you want. It's not, you know, trading shells for buffalo robes. Instead, you require it, which means we could all become just the most enlightened beings on the entire planet, and it wouldn't matter. The U.S. military would still have to be huge, because otherwise, how are we ever going to get our access to our oil that's under somebody else's land? And so that's on a functional level. That's why it's not redeemable on a functional level, which I think for current purposes is really, and we can talk psychologically and socially about why it is too, but I think for the current purposes, that's actually the most important reason, is because psychologically and socially are really important, but once again, it doesn't matter. You could have this huge transformation of the heart, and if you still require the importation of resources, what are you going to do about it?
Let's build a boat in case the waters rise. Let's build a boat.
Our current economic paradigm goes back to the days of European colonialism. European society was basically expanding outward to encompass the rest of the world, to control the rest of the world's resources. And so that created economic growth for Europe. And so the very first economic theorists started to build this idea of growth into their theories. Now, during the 19th and 20th centuries, as fossil fuels came along, we had enormous expansion in human capabilities. We had energy available to fuel industrialization and the growth of everything, of mechanization, using machines to do work that formerly had been done by human beings. So that also created enormous growth. So as economics, as a system developed, of course, we think of economics these days as a science, but economics is not a science. It started out as a moral philosophy, and it still is, in effect, a kind of moral philosophy. But into the very bedrock of economics, whether it's leftist economics or rightist economics, Marxist or free market, it doesn't matter. It's all basically the same, is this idea that mechanization is inevitable, and that the economy will, can, and must continue to grow. Now, of course, this is an absurdity because we live on a finite spherical planet. So there's only so much stuff to chew up and spit out. But we have this economic theory now that we're burdened with, which says that we have to chew up and spit out more all the time. We've even created a monetary system that underscores this. Our money is created through bank loans these days. It's not backed up by gold or silver. It's essentially fiat money that's created by the act of making a loan. When the loan's repaid, the money disappears. So all of those loans, of course, have interest attached to them. So if the interest is going to be paid on all of the loans that exist, that means that the money supply has to continually grow. And if the money supply stops growing, that means that a lot of people are going to default on their loans, and money just disappears from the economy, and we have a deflationary depression, which is what we had back in the 1930s. So in order to avoid a deflationary depression, we have to have continual growth in the money supply, which has to be based on continual growth in economic activity, which must be based on the continual growth in available energy and raw materials to fuel economic activity. Well, of course, that's simply not in the cards. We can't have that because it's physically impossible.
Thank you.
By the time Columbus got here in 1492, see, people have many opinions about him, who he was or what he was, but whatever, see, he was really like the virus. You know? And the spirit was being eaten by disease, and it affected the perceptual reality of the human. See, so when Columbus and him got here, and we told them who we were, they didn't know. We said, well, we're the people, we're the human beings. But they didn't know because it wasn't a part of their perceptional reality. The concept was no longer a part of their perceptional reality. See, this is what happened to the tribes of Europe and the descendants of the tribes of Europe. And so I know that by the time Columbus got here, and I got a pretty good idea way before that, but by the time Columbus got here, the idea of a human being and people in that kind of a way was no longer a part of their perceptional reality. And we'll look at, but what did Columbus come out of? See, when he got here, this hemisphere had no protection to this disease because it had never been here like that. So there was no immune system to the disease as it moved, because the disease came through the wind and the water. So it was airborne in a way and water carried. So it just took the shape of a man rather than something you can't see. But it arrived. Right, and this spirit that was being eaten, which made this diseased perception of reality. So by the time Columbus got here, all right, let's look about 1100 AD or 1000 AD, the church made the decision that it was God's government. It was the authority of God on earth, so it was God's government. And at that time, the descendants of the tribes of Europe no longer remembered that they come from tribes. This wasn't really a part of their conscious reality. Because by 1000 AD, see, they had been owned by, they'd been owned for many, many, many generations by whoever claimed ownership of the land and started owning the land. And then they became fiefs, and they became serfs, and they became peasants. So they really had no reality about being a part of the tribe anymore, because they were just the property that was owned like whoever the landlord was, or the royalty at any given time that owned that land or claimed that land. They belonged that land like all of the other natural resources of the land. But they still prayed to spirits. See, they still, the women still had a stronger role yet from the old tribal way, and they still prayed to spirits. So the church, by 1000 AD or 1100 AD, it decided that it was now going to mine this resource. I mean, save the souls of the heathen, see. So the church created the Inquisition, and basically the Inquisition was, number one, is it was to change the perceptual reality of the descendants of the tribes of Europe. All right, and so they were terrorized and brutalized for 500 years in order to do this. But the way the church rationalized this was they were going to save, they wanted to possess the souls of the heathens and the pagans. See, they wanted to possess their souls in the name of their Lord. All right, so this war was to about possessing the souls of the descendants of tribes of Europe. And in order to possess their souls, they had to alter their perceptional reality. So if you thought differently than the church wanted you to think, bingo, you were killed. And you were tortured and your property was taken. And if somebody accused you, basically you were guilty if you were accused. You don't know, incidentally, during the torturing process, you'd probably say somebody else's name, so now somebody else is going to kind of... So they killed as efficiently as they possibly could with the technology they had at hand at the time. And they did it for 500 years. By the time Columbus got here, it had been going on for 400 years. And by the time Columbus got here, let's say 20 years to a generation, just for the lifespan during that time frame. All right? So by the time Columbus got here, the descendants of the tribes of Europe had been through 20 generations of having their spirit just completely attacked. And the way this possessed thing kind of just seems to manifest itself, so they became spiritually and physically now the possession of something else. See, then before that it was just physically. Now they had become spiritually the possession of someone else. See, so they had no clarity about reality. So by the time Columbus got here, see, they didn't know what it meant to be a human being anymore. It was just not a part of their spiritual perceptional relationship to reality. They were possessed, they were owned, they were property. You know, and one of the other things about this that kind of evolved out of that, I think it evolved out of that, was anyway, when the church was doing all of this to get the descendants of the tribes of Europe, all right, they finally figured out, well, hold it, if I want to stay alive and be a descendant of anything, I'm going to have to accept these people. So they embraced the church because they had to embrace what they feared. So they had to love what they feared in order to survive. And what they had to love, the thing that they had to love that they feared was possessing them. So it's like love and fear and possession as a perceptual reality kind of became intertwined at that time, and the human beings have not been able to sort it out yet. So that affected everyone in some kind of a way that's not been healthy for us as human beings. So anyway, anything and all of these things that have happened to us through our generational evolution has been a learning experience, has been a part of our evolutionary experience.
Very successful movie and previous to that book not too many years ago called The Perfect Storm, in which this horrendous storm comes about because of several smaller storms that coalesce into one giant catastrophe. I think something like that is developing for industrial civilization as a whole. We have peak oil, we have global climate change, which is becoming just a horrendous, horrendous catastrophe on the horizon, with, you know, the polar ice melting, which is opening huge areas of sea in the polar regions. Without that ice, which normally reflects sunlight, that polar sea is now going to be absorbing a lot more sunlight and therefore heat, and causing kind of a self-reinforcing feedback loop. So it's very possible that global climate change is out of our control at this point, no matter what we do, whether we implement Kyoto or Kyoto on steroids or whatever it is. It's really too late to do much about it. And then global population growth. We've probably already overshot the Earth's long-term carrying capacity for human beings. We passed 6 billion in, I think, 1998 or 1999. Just since then, we've added another 500 million people. So the rate of growth is starting to slow, but we're still adding people every year, something like 80 million people a year. We're not adding resources to feed all of those people and keep them in the way of life to which they would like to become accustomed. And then producing food for all of those people is a problem because we're running out of arable land and fresh water. So in fact, the per capita rate of food production has been declining for the past several years, even though population is still increasing. So you start adding all of these things together, and how peak oil will further undermine global carrying capacity for the growing population, and how global climate change will do the same thing. And it's not too hard to start coming up with real sort of doomsday scenarios. Now, no one wants to see that happen, but, you know, we've really been ignoring these problems for far too long. And if you ignore problems for too long, they come to a crisis stage, and that's what we're looking at.
Let's build a boat in case the waters rise. Let's build a boat.
Many analysts. Naturalists think it started about 10,000 years ago when humans began to engage in a new and fundamentally unsustainable style of food production.
What we invented was something that I call totalitarian agriculture, which is predicated on the notion that it all belongs to us. We can kill off anything we don't want on the land, put a fence around the land, we can grow the food we want on the land, and nobody else can touch it.
That slippery slope that we're on right now, we started walking on that 10,000 years ago. And it is because of an inherent problem in agriculture. Agriculture really depends on disturbance. There's no way you can do agriculture without doing that catastrophic damage. So it makes agriculture fundamentally unsustainable.
The surplus from this new way of getting food had immediate effects.
It has fueled this tremendous population growth of ours. Our growing population is always catching up with our food production. We have a food race on our hands.
We grow more food and the population increases. So we grow more food. It's a race that can't be won. On top of that, totalitarian agriculture also consigned its practitioners to a life of hard work and poor health.
As a species, we had food before us for all of our history, which is 200, 300,000 years. When you look at 10,000 years, it's relatively minor in that space. But we were hunter-gatherers. And so nature grew our food in its way as opposed to our way, which is agriculture. We didn't grow food. Food grew.
Yeah, it's hard for people to accept the fact that the more you base your society on agriculture, the harder you work.
If we look at archaeological sites around the world, and people have done this, and all the locations, this is not a cultural issue, in all the locations where agriculture began, in Asia, the Mideast, South America, and Central America, we will find people who are stunted, short, their teeth are invariably gone because of the carbohydrates they're eating turn into sugars and rot their teeth out. They're misshapen, they're asymmetrical, they show every evidence of suffering all sorts of disease.
This new type of agriculture both required and allowed more settlement, and with that came the beginnings of wealth and inequity.
If you go to pre-agricultural towns, you'll see a series of houses all about the same size. And almost instantly, when agriculture occurred, you can go to any town in any agricultural site in the world, not just in Western culture, and see a few very large houses with granaries connected to them and a whole series of smaller houses. That kind of social inequity began almost immediately with agriculture.
Before, when women were moving around and very athletic and carrying their babies and having a diet that wasn't so high in carbohydrates and nursing their babies for long periods of time, then women did not ovulate very often. But when women became sedentary, women began to have regular cycles. And so more babies were born. And so guess what? Then you have to make more farm. And then you have to expand the area that's fenced off. And then, oh, maybe you're going to meet up with someone else who's coming that way, you know, another group. And so then you have to have a war. So we've got this kind of innate mechanism that was highly functional for most of human history, which was to respond to the immediate threat of things. The tiger, the fire, the neighboring tribe that was on the border. Now the threats don't have that kind of immediacy. They require an ability that we actually have, which is to think abstractly and to think long term and to use our huge brains to imagine long term consequences and scenarios. But we're not really using them to respond to the actual threats that we're facing: resource depletion, climate change, extinction of species, overpopulation. These are all things that have a gradual and cumulative effect and are degrading the systems that we depend on. But they're not doing it in an instant, in a flash. They're doing it gradually, moment by moment, day by day, year by year. Everything is degrading. Now, things may speed up here at the end. The hurricanes are one example of where things have sped up, and we're starting to see huge impacts as a result of these long-term slow processes that we've set into motion by degrading the environment and polluting the air and depleting our resources. So there may be some things that actually hit us fairly rapidly as things get worse and worse. But if we're going to forestall total collapse and total catastrophe and extinction of the species, we're going to have to start using our big brains to do what they actually can do, which is to think big and long term. And so far, especially in the capitalist system, and the capitalist system as it's evolved in the last probably 10 or 20 years, all people are worried about is the next quarter profits. They're not thinking about their grandchildren. They're certainly not thinking the way Earth-based peoples thought about the seventh generation. It's kind of sad, isn't it, to think that people aren't thinking that our so-called advanced civilization as we're living in it today, that all we're thinking about are the next quarter's profits rather than the seventh generation to come. It's very sad, and it will be devastating if we don't start thinking that way.
Let's build a boat in case the waters rise. Let's build a boat.
Keeping this drive to exceed limits or not come to terms with limits, what's keeping it going? What's the psychological mechanism that keeps that push to exceed limits going? So there's the addiction answer, which is we've gotten addicted. We've taken the substitutes of what this culture has to offer, and it doesn't really satisfy us. But like any good addiction, we keep trying more of it, thinking more will do better. A little bit of television in the 1950s will keep the kids quiet. Now it's you got to watch television 24 hours a day. You got it on your cell phone. It's like it's never ending. So I think that's part of it, is we've gotten addicted to comfort and diversion and entertainment. And that's keeping us from just coming to terms with limits, which will naturally throw us into some pain, looking at the limits. It's kind of like a mother with a two-year-old. It's painful in the immediate moment to set a limit and say, no, it's time to clean up the toys. It's easier to say, okay, I'll clean up the toys. Here, have a snack. Here, have some candy. Here, go watch television while I clean up the toys. It's easier to do that in the short run. But what it yields is kids that are out of control, who have no sense of their own competence, who can't trust themselves or the world because they're just always pushing for more. And they can't just sit with, oh, this is a new task I get to learn. So in some ways, we're in a culture of two-year-olds where we just won't look at the limits. We just keep making fancier and more entertaining and more diverting activities, rather than kind of coming to terms with, oh, we've got to shift. We have to change. We have to grow in a different way now.
Americans need to be defended from each other at all times. They pose a greater danger to each other than most other nations. This is currently done by the police and through the outrageously high prison population, because of all the unsolved social problems that have been swept under the rug for decades, sometimes for hundreds of years. And so the problem with police is that police safeguard property because their income and their budgets are based on tax receipts. So, for instance, Beverly Hills is very well defended, and, you know, eastern Los Angeles, much less so. You know, that's a typical example. The problem is that when municipal budgets more or less go away, the police become much less eager to defend people from each other and much more eager to defend themselves and their own families and look out for their own interests. So I think that the U.S. military has a big role to play in domestic peacekeeping. I think that all of these troops that are repatriated will need to be placed in various urban areas to keep the peace. And the other thing that can be done very usefully with the military is that, you know, the military is a unique organization because they just follow orders. You don't necessarily need a big budget. You don't need a recruitment arm if the people are already there. So you can basically tell them to do things like grow potatoes, like truck in dirt from the suburbs and nail together boxes in parking lots in inner cities for raised bed agriculture, like drag Jersey barriers into place to block off raised highways and use them instead to put together water collection systems because there won't be any traffic anyway. All of these things can be done very efficiently and quickly by the military. And when nothing is moving because the wheels of commerce and finance are stuck in mud, the military can be the only thing that, you know, the President of the United States, federal authorities, and state authorities can call on to actually get useful things accomplished.
I know that some writers that have been influential recently made the statement that approximately that agriculture is to blame for all this. And this represents a misunderstanding of what agriculture is. Agriculture is nothing more than fostering the regrowth of the foods that you favor. And my guess is that humans have been doing that for hundreds of thousands of years. We did not invent agriculture. What we invented was something that I call totalitarian agriculture, which is predicated on the notion that it all belongs to us. Everything. Every bit of it. And we can do with it what we want. If we see a piece of land, it belongs to us. We can kill off anything we don't want on the land, put a fence around the land. We can grow the food we want on the land, and nobody else can touch it. So that's the totalitarian mindset. And that's our form of agriculture. But if you go among tribal peoples around the world, the ones that remain, most of them are agriculturalists. But they have no such notions about their agriculture. So that's the difference. And I would agree that totalitarian agriculture has been a disaster. Mainly because it has fueled this tremendous population growth of ours. For Malthus, he thought that we were always catching up with our growing population, whereas in fact, our growing population is always catching up with our food production. We have a food race on our hands, which is like the Cold War arms race, where we would make a weapon, the Russians would make a better weapon. Well, we'd have to make a better weapon. They'd make a better weapon. We'd make a better weapon, and so on. And that's what made it a race. And it was, of course, perpetually escalating. It was, you know, extremely dangerous, obviously. And the only way to end it was the way that Gorbachev ended it. He said, we quit. No one to race with. We are in a food race, and everyone is pulling for food production because our population is growing. But of course, every time we make a win on the side of food production, there's a win on the side of population growth. Win, 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 win. That's why we're annually adding 77 million people to our population. And people had this terrible delusion that we're growing more food in order to feed the starving. The starving do not get fed. The starving population is a growing population, just the way every other part of the population is growing. It's a delusion. We are growing more food to grow more people.
About an animal in a zoo. An animal's deprived of the very things that keep that animal going, the smells, the sights, the sounds, the instincts, the hunting. And they become psychotic. Literally psychotic. I mean, their behavior is gone. They're social animals, and we can understand their behavior, and so the term psychotic makes sense in wolves, for instance. Dogs, certainly. More psychotic dogs around us than any other kind. And I think that we've done something to ourselves that is exactly analogous to that. We've put ourselves in a cage, in this cage of civilization, of cities. And it's made us, in a way, psychotic. That if you would have a group of hunter-gatherers, and this has happened a lot, hunter-gatherers watch behavior of people in our society, they would think we were crazy for the way we behave, because we are. And we become crazy because we've lost that physical contact with what goes on around us. We are sensual beings. We try to replace it in a jillion different ways. That's why music is so important to us, art is so important to us. But it's a substitute for what was there all along, that opening that can occur from being out there. And it's difficult to explain it to someone who's never experienced it. But when you've experienced it, it's not some great magical, mystical thing so much as it's just very real. It's just a sensual thing to simply go back and live the way that we were evolved to live. We can think of this also in terms of ethics, and I've finally decided to define ethics as being true to your genetic heritage in some way. In that we try to deny that genetic heritage and say that we are not that way, that we are not animal, and therefore we suppress those things within us. But I think that a proper system would examine as deeply as we can and as rationally as we can what we are and what we're meant to be, and then allow your life to somehow mirror that, mirror your genetic heritage in some way.
Let's build a boat in case the waters rise. Let's build a boat. The clouds, they gather in the sky. Let's build a boat. For when this storm comes. Let's build a boat. For when the rain it beat like drums. But you can't outrun the water. Oh, you can't outrun the water. You can't outrun the water. Let's build a boat.
Do you represent a civilization?
I represent a group of civilizations.
Where is this group of civilizations?
All around you.
What is your purpose in coming here?
There is a gathering of world leaders not far from here. I will explain my purpose to them.
I'm afraid that's not possible. Perhaps you should explain yourself to me instead.
Do you speak for the entire human race?
I speak for the President of the United States. Now please, tell me, why have you come to our planet?
Your planet?
Yes, this is our planet.
No, it is not.
Moths and other sacred wings, butterflies and bees whisper, in breath of the wind, blessed way, blessing way things. Dreams are the mind's streams, thought pictures of the spirit. There are dreams of the day, there are dreams of the night. Thinking and dreaming are related. Dreams of the day we make our own, dreams of night, part of eternal stone. There are dream takers, taking from dream worlds, taking dreams as a way of stealing thoughts, turning minds inside and out. Dream slavers want to change our connections to ourselves, mess with our dreams, make us unsure, unclear about right and wrong, feed our dreams and instincts to industrial profit machine. Difference between dream and fantasy, reality and illusion. Center and no center. Dreams of the day keep our spirit alive, our creative mind, who we really are. With dreams we can create and heal, follow our original purpose. Dreams are protection, good medicine. Blessed way things. Sun and moon continue. We are all on one journey.